just in terms of me and by way of introduction to me, it amazes me how little I understood. Ricky and I were talking about this a little bit yesterday, how little I understood about myself and the world by the time that I was 23 years old and out of college and out of my supposed education that is going to prepare me for living a happy and productive life, that I was completely ignorant of what it meant to be a friend to someone, of what it meant to understand what I really wanted out of life, to understand anything about what motivated me. I was just simply a person who, if you had asked me, who are you? I would have said, I'm the guy sitting in front of you. I would have been the guy that Rose made fun of during the lecture. You know, I'd be like, I'm the guy right here sitting in front of you, Sean Nevins. That's who I am. Simple as that. And I can point to, I have one memory of being in college and walking out behind the dorm, and there was a little grassy area with some pine trees in it. I have a single memory from my college years of sitting out there and being a little bummed out that my college, my social experience in college wasn't really what I wanted it to be. So maybe it was Friday night and I didn't have anything to do. And sitting out there and hearing the wind blowing through the pine trees, the first time in my life maybe I ever really was by myself, and I heard that wind blowing through and wondering that some kind of vague question of just wondering, well, what is my life about, or why am I here, or what's going to happen to me? I have that instance in my mind. And then one other time in college, I was laying in bed and I was thinking about what happens after I die. And I remember my mind sort of going out towards a picture of the universe and expanding out into my imagination of the universe. And what's the edge of the universe? What is that? Where is that? And my mind trying to grapple with that. And just, there's nothing to grab onto. I just couldn't, my thought just faded or dissipated out into nothing. I don't know. I have those two memories. And then I just went back to studying and reading books and preparing for my piece of the American dream. I think when I was younger, I wasn't ambitious. Just give me a little piece of my dream. That's all I want. You know, just a little something for me. A little house somewhere, a wife, some peace, a job that's not too hard, enough money to get by on. Just give me that and I'll be satisfied. And I had a picture in my head of what that looked like. And you know, that's what I was going for. That was the extent of my imagination of what life could be about. It wasn't so bad, really, you know. I describe it right now. What's wrong with that? Isn't that enough? You know? And when I got to graduate school, pursuing that dream, I wanted to be a professor of soil science. Right? Not soul science. Soil science. Dirt. And you may ask, how could someone ever come up with such a goal for that's what they want to do? And I'll tell you how. Because when I was a freshman and they asked me, well, what do you want to do? What are you going to major in? I I was flipping through the course catalog, right, that described all the different things that you could do. Oh, there's chemistry, biology, and engineering, and physics, and English, and all the many things. And they all had a picture with them as well. Well, when you, agriculture, which is kind of the beginning of the book, had this picture of a farm and some rolling hills, and there were some horses scattered here and there. And I thought, I like that. That's a nice picture. As opposed to the physicist with goggles on or something in a lab, and yeah, flask, and or someone writing or reading or all that business. Yeah, engineering. No. So I, you know, a feeling is what drove me, really, when it comes down to it. A feeling or a nostalgia, I mean, it really boils back to me to a nostalgic idea. Some feeling of that picture appeals to a part of me, a very fundamental part of me. There's something that's pulling me in that. Not ambition or acquisition, really, but there's something perfect about that. And sticking Sean into that picture, that means now he's there, and he wants to be there. So that's how I got into that whole business.
You do look a bit like that guy in the American Gothic that you pitched for.
That's not good. Especially the, as I recall, the lady next to him.
Stern character.
Rather grim.
It's a little hard to put that together with Berkeley, too.
Where I am now.
Picture, yeah.
Yeah. So, so I pursued that, and I went to graduate school, and that's where it really began to dawn on me, well, the reality of being in research, being in the academic situation, the things that you have to do, the things that you have to exchange to get the things that you want, that you maybe you don't necessarily get to study what you're interested in. You need to do some research and where some grant money is. You know, as I was encouraged by my professors, I had a project I wanted to do with earthworms and how they increase the organic matter in the soil. And they said, well, that's well and good, but we just bought this gas chromatograph, paid $15,000 or whatever for it, and we don't have anybody using it. And if you could do a project about, you know, the nitrogen, whatever, I can hardly remember what it was, decomposition, the amount of nitrogen that's coming out of the soil, that would be very good if you could do that. And I was highly encouraged to do that. So I sold out and said, okay, well, I'll do that. So I started to see a little bit of the how academics ran in terms of that. And I remember seeing some older professors talking about how the young professors were the ones who were really bringing in money. And they were just kind of kicked back now and waiting for retirement, basically. So I became somewhat disillusioned with that. And then I fell in love. And then I became very disillusioned with everything. And that sort of... I definitely fall into the camp that without tension, people in general don't do anything. They puddle. They relax. They don't make any progress. No thought. It takes tension to generate thought. Intention in my life, I was not a naturally philosophic person. I was not just curious. Just curiosity for me didn't drive me into spiritual seeking. That thought of what happens after I die, or what is at the edge of the universe, what's out there, what those conceptual thoughts, they weren't enough for me. There wasn't a passion behind that. For some people, I think there is. There's just a, I just want to know. This just bugs the hell out of me, and I want to know. And that can drive them. But for me, it took trauma to drive me to think. And the trauma that started my thinking was really relationship and feeling at feeling dis-ease being by myself and feeling alone in the world and wanting some person to be with me. And the feeling that if I had another person that I would, that loved me and I loved them, that that would fill this hole that was inside of me and complete that picture. That's part of the picture of perfection. That, to me, was part of the nostalgia. It wasn't... It was connected with another person. And so I fell in love. Right? That was my first experience of falling in love. And literally, it feels like falling into something I don't really understand, being swept up by that desire. And it's a mix of desire and longing and nostalgia and all that twirled in, and just the the chemistry, the sexuality, all that mixed in this confusing mass of this other person is the thing that I want more than anything else. And then I get rejected by the other person. And I learned that they don't feel the same way about me. And all my imaginations of this life that we're going to live together and this way that we're going to feel about each other, that's not true. And so that left me... I get you. Probably almost all of us, if not all of us, have experienced that complete heartbreak of I wanted something so badly and it's never going to happen. And for me, since I fell in love, it seemed like it never would happen because that was the person it was going to happen with. That was my destiny, to be with that person, and it didn't happen. And now it's never going to happen, and I'm never going to find that, and I'm never going to get that little thing that I wanted. So that just depression, right? And just completely depressed. And what is this all about? What am I? I got nothing, right? I got nothing. The thing that I had, I don't have anymore. And now what? And I don't know. So that openness, right? All my dreams get swept aside. And before I could build a new dream, and that's the thing, we recover. We don't believe that we'll recover, but we recover. We fall out of love, then we fall in love with someone else. We build a new dream, and then we go off after that. Well, occasionally, you get lucky, if you can call it luck, and something inserts itself in that mechanism of one dream followed by the next dream, followed by the next dream, by the next dream, by the next dream, and then you're 80, and you look back upon a life of dreaming, and then you wonder, then you realize that, well, the end is here, and there's no more time for any new dream, which is where my mom is now. She's 80, right? And it's beginning to dawn that, the doctor said my heart stopped for 7 seconds. And now all my projection out into the future is coming to an end. So I got lucky in that that dreaming cycle was stopped for a moment. Because I saw a poster, and I was in an open state of mind, I saw a poster that said, "What is enlightenment?" And there was a picture of Richard Rose on the poster, and I had no idea who it was, but it paused me in a moment of between one dream and the next dream. And I thought, what is that? Is that Is there some answer there into why I'm so miserable and having nothing? Is there something there that would be fulfilling? Is there an answer there to what life is about or what my life is about? And so I went to this talk and saw Richard Rose and distinctly remember having no clue what he was talking about. He read the lecture of questions, which is literally a series of questions that I think begins something like, does a man own a house or does the house own him? And these things that he phrased it as they're modern day koans, modern day questions. They're forks in the eye of what I believe. You know, do I own a house or am I actually a slave to the house? And he read through all these questions, but most of them didn't mean anything to me. As a college kid, what does that mean? Do I own a house or does the house own me? That doesn't mean anything to me. And I don't recall any of the questions sticking with me. But what I do distinctly recall is as he looked around the audience, he was talking to me. And his gaze, it's like he was looking right at me and talking person to person to me and saying, there's something here. I have something for you. And this is an opportunity to go for it or to pursue it. And I left that talk curious. What is this guy? What is this? What is this guy talking about? What is enlightenment? And somebody, thank God, somebody, as I was leaving, they had a notebook where you write down your contact information, and I wrote down my contact information, wrote down my phone number, and Bill McKee, who some of you know, he was the kid who wrote down my contact info, and he called me on the telephone a week later and said, hey, we got a meeting. We meet every week, and come to this meeting. That was the Self-Knowledge Symposium. And that started me, that started my fascination, that started my curiosity about spiritual seeking and about what can life be. And maybe that was, in the beginning, as much as anything else, is what could life really be? What could I be besides this little piece, this little dream that I had? What was the possibilities for life? Something more than something more than imagination, something more than a picture in a book. And I was exposed to, looking back on it now, I was exposed to a limitless expanse of what one could make their life. And that runs the gamut from being a successful entrepreneur to pursuing enlightenment. I was exposed to the huge expanse of what life could be, largely through Augie Turak, who some of you know as well, who had in his own life run a gamut of experience from successful entrepreneur to Zen student to everything in between. And it was just eye-opening for me of what I could do, what I could choose to do. So I got heavily into the Self-Knowledge Symposium, and a lot of the Self-Knowledge Symposium was psychological work, which Ricky and I talked a little bit about yesterday. And by psychological work, I mean how do you become a man? How do you become a human being is a better way to phrase it. How do you do the basics? How do you succeed? How do you keep a commitment? How do you understand the things that motivate you? How do you keep yourself motivated? How do you discover what you really want out of life? These basic things that you think you would be taught in high school or earlier. How do I figure out what I really want to do? Well, that didn't happen until, you know, some little club in college that I never had access to. And it exposed me to all these thoughts. And it exposed me to one of the very first books I read was Uspensky's The Psychology of Man's Possible Evolution. And I, what the hell? There are many eyes within me? That was Uspensky's take. There are many selves within the self. And they all want different things. And I realized, looking at me, that yes, that's true. And I never thought about it before. And my interpretation of his idea was, we have to take these selves and build a magnetic center, I think he called it, about one thing that we want, one desire that we want, and coalesce these selves around that. And that was so incredible to read. And to begin to learn about myself. It was called the Self-Knowledge Symposium for a reason. Beginning to learn about myself. And that was what I was preoccupied with for a long time. Was learning the basics about a human being and human psychology. Practical human psychology. And throughout that, though, there's this figure of Richard Rose up in West Virginia and what is enlightenment. And that was always woven through the idea that I understood. As I understood it at the time, you had to become a person who could accomplish things because we were talking about pursuing spiritual enlightenment, which is the highest, loftiest goal in the spiritual pantheon. It's the peak of the peak, and only the true seekers can get there. Only the most dedicated, the hardest working, the one out of a million are the only people who are going to get it. And if you want that, then you got to become one of the one out of the million. And you got to become somebody who, regardless of what's in front of them, they're going to plow through it. Setbacks aren't going to set you back. You'll keep moving towards the thing that you want. So that was the mindset that I was in. So we went up as a group to see Richard Rose, and for the first time in my life, I sat in rapport with a group of people, and in that experience, which is on that Richard Rose, Mr. Rose DVD, I had an experience of knowing that Rose had what I was looking for. It's the best way that I can phrase it. That there was a truth and that he had it. And that was the thing that I wanted. So that was one of those milestones for me, of actually having a tangible feel, not just the idea that there is a enlightenment or there is an answer, but feeling and knowing that, yeah, there's something out there. And I thought of it as out there. You're probably saying, well, it's not out there, it's in here. You know, that's a misconception. It doesn't matter. What matters is that you have a taste and that you know that it's real. And what we're talking about is real. So how to get there? And the way to get there is is not through the psychological work. It's not through the character building, the character development. That's part of a path. It was part of a path for me because I wasn't a person who could set a goal in mind and keep at it. I wasn't a person who could have meditated every day, let's say. I wasn't a person who could accomplish things. But I became a person who could accomplish things and understand when I was lying to myself. That's probably another key thing that I learned, is how to understand when I'm not being truthful with myself, when I'm rationalizing. We used to talk so much about rationalization. And how if I'm late to an appointment, I say, well, traffic was bad. No, I had a phone call. It's not really important that I get there on time because I get there most of the meetings on time anyway. And we come up with all these reasons to let the tension off of ourselves and say, it's okay, you're okay, and it's okay that this time that I was late. And that, as I learned, that's rationalization. And with enough rationalizations, eventually you don't go to the meeting at all. Because it becomes a nice way to let yourself off the hook of something that maybe you don't want to do all the time. And to recognize that mechanism in oneself and to say, you know, I'm not being honest with myself. That was a revelation for me. But I finally realized that all of that was working on the level of Sean and the personality and self, and that would only take you so far, and that was a good thing because there's nothing wrong at all with being a better human being, and the world is a better place for all the work that all the people did in the Self-Knowledge Symposium and all the groups out there where they focus on just being good people. And I wish that everyone had that opportunity, every kid, every student had that opportunity to learn something about themselves and interacting with others. But if you want something more, then there's another level of looking, if you will, and that is the realization that the answer is within. The answer is not in another person. The answer is not in, as the Zen masters would say, polishing the turd, polishing the character until the character is perfect and saintly. But it dawned upon me after spending a week in isolation on retreat by myself in a cabin that the answer to who am I or what happens to me after I die is in directly looking for the source of myself. And that's not found through manipulating the self. That's found by, in whatever way works for you, staring at the place or the space out of which the self emerges, out of which the I am emerges, or out of which thought emerges, out of which feeling emerges. That there is a, it's like there's a gate or a window out of which we come into the world, and that the person, the individual, can stare at that window, can stare at their source. And if they could stare at it long enough and hard enough and intensely enough, they would look through that window and see who they really are. And that became my direction, my route, my practice, was to stare at that window. And I stared at that window as hard as I could, as long as I could, as many times as I could, out of the belief that that's how things are done. That's how you get to the top of the mountain, is by working harder, working as hard as you can. And so, you know, I wound up moving to Rose's Farm out of that fundamental belief that if you want to succeed at something, devote yourself entirely to it. And so that meant leaving school and leaving distractions, not, you know, trying not to work, because working in terms of making money, trying to get away from all of that, get away from the world so I can just do this one thing. And fortunately, Rose provided that opportunity. For $50 a month, you can come and stay. And if you want to, you can freaking stay in a cabin and stare at the inside of your head as much as you want to. And it's my belief that he felt that if you were doing the work, you could stay there as long as you wanted to. If you were keeping it try, if you were just trying it. And he pretty much, he did. He just left me alone. I remember when I got up there and he said something along the lines of just go out in the cabin and spend time by yourself, have a couple of books. If you run into any trouble, come see me. Done. Right? End of Zen Master advice. And I would do that as much as I could. I, believe me, I was intimidated by the guy and nervous around the guy and all that. And I didn't want to go see him. But I would get to the point where I would run myself into a hole and I don't know what to do now. And I'm depressed and I'm never going to get enlightened. And I'm going to go into town and have a cup of tea with Richard Rose. And he would get me pumped back up that... Yes, this is possible. He did it. I can do it. He wouldn't say anything like that, believe me. But just being in his presence reminded me that this is the thing I want more than anything else. And I think a lot of the path is simply that, reminding yourself of what you want more than anything else. And then I start sounding like Dave Weimer. Those of you who know Dave Weimer, he would just say, if you want something more than anything else, you'll get it. Simple as that. Well, it's not quite as simple as that, because we can't remember what we want. Because the moment we walk out the door, we're bombarded with 100 other things calling to us. And saying, I need your attention, Tyler. I need you to deal with this bill. And I need you to love me. And I need you to pay attention to me. And all these things grabbing at us and calling to us. And what do we have to do? We have to look at them. We have to deal with them. And then we have to try to remember to spend a little time coming back to the thing that is in here that we want. So I was lucky to have a space that the distractions were minimized. But here's what you have to remember as well. I've told this story before. Here I am out in the wilderness and I'm working hard, right? And what am I thinking about? Oh, the mail is supposed to come at 1. Maybe I'll have a letter. Or maybe the green tab will be in the mailbox. And the green tab was this little for sale classified paper where they had cars for sale and refrigerators and all the detritus that everybody in Moundsville, West Virginia was trying to get rid of. Oh, that'd be I could thumb through that for a few minutes. And that'll be a break. Right? So even then, you're called to by little desires that, you know, pay attention to me for a few minutes. Look away. So there's always an excuse. There's always a distraction is all I'm trying to say. Always be dealing with that. But I tried, you know, looking back on it, I tried. And I tried to the best of my ability. And those of you who know me, and if you look at me right now, I'm not Mr. Mountain Climber, full of energy. I can run and break through that wall right now. That's not me. And it doesn't matter. And I didn't realize this until years later, that I didn't have to be Richard Rose. I didn't have to be the guy who could, you know, see a woman in trouble and surrounded by five guys and walk over there caring less that regardless of what happened to him, he's going to save this person. I could be afraid. I could be weak. I could think that there's no way that I'm going to do this. I could just be who I was, yet each person can work to the best of their ability. And that's all that matters, is that you as an individual, not in comparison to anyone else, that you as an individual have the capability and the capacity to accomplish whatever it is that you desire. And that may sound kind of corny, but it's true. And the problem is finding what is the thing that you really desire. We tell things like that to children, and they say, I want to be president of the United States. You can do that, young man, young woman. You can do that. Is that the thing that they are really called to do in life? That's the piece that we don't teach them, in my opinion. We pump them up. You can. Some kids get pumped up. You can do anything. But how do I figure out what it is I want to do? So I eventually ground to a halt and came to a dead end on trying to look directly through that window. And I think this is worth saying. I still believe that the most direct path to enlightenment, the shortest path to enlightenment, is if you have that curiosity and you have that desire to stare at that space, to stare at the I am, and that is a way to the potential is there to directly see, to have a revelation of your true nature. But for some reason or another, I stared at that, stared at that, stared at that until I couldn't do it anymore. And I phrased that as breaking my hammer against the wall. That is a tool. And that tool was meditation. And then I knocked and knocked at the gate of heaven until it broke. And I got to the point where I could not, mentally, I just couldn't look anymore. If I even thought of meditating, I just turned away from it. I couldn't do it. And I went through quite a period of time of, what do I have? What am I going to do? Because by this point in time, Richard Rose was in a care unit for Alzheimer's patients. He wasn't a teacher for me anymore. And you know, this is that point in time where I'm on the farm, and there was one other person on the farm. It's like me and Dave Weimer. Just hard. This is a horrible, depressing, gray. Yeah, Sean's like, oh God, this is a bad period of time because I can't meditate. I don't want to read anything because I've read all the damn books, and I don't know what to do, and I'm just screwed. I got no teacher. I got nothing, and I was pretty desperate. I just don't know where to turn. What to do? Somebody once described me to me at that period of time as, you're like a climber who has let go of the hold and doesn't have the next hold. And that space of, I don't know where the next hold is. I'm feeling around for the next hold, and I'm about ready to fall off of this precarious little place where I am. And I think we all come to places like that where we don't know what to do next. And the thing is to not... I phrase it as treading water. The thing is to tread water at that point in time. Not to turn around and swim back towards the shore. Because you think, oh, well, back there is at least something for me. At least if I go back that way, I can have a relationship. Or I can have a career. Or whatever it is. Or I can have that little house. If I just, oh, I'll start swimming back towards that little house in the woods somewhere. At least I can have that in life. The thing is to just tread water in that place of not knowing until something comes. And something will come. And I don't know how long you'll have to tread water, but something will come. And for me, what came is a different tool, and that was intuition. A different way of it was really a different way of looking towards that window, rather than with my mind forcing and staring and intensely with effort staring at that window, learning to relax and see what came out of the window. It was like looking at that window sideways, looking at that window out of the corner of my eye. And the tool for that was writing and writing poetry. But not writing poetry. I wasn't writing poetry, I was writing words that came to me. And so the tool was listening for the words that were coming. Because that was another way of attending to the window out of which creation came, out of which I was coming out. So I would go off into the woods and just sit with a notebook until something came to me. And that in itself is meditation. But it's a very different kind of, for me, it's a very different experience of meditation. Or I would sit and wait for a feeling to come to me. Not look for a feeling, but sit, just like Eckhart Tolle says, sit at the
mouse hole,
right? The cat sitting at the mouse hole waiting. And I remember trying to describe to somebody on the farm what I was doing, and I said, I'm waiting. He's like, you can't. What are you talking about? You can't just sit and wait. You gotta be attacking. You gotta be doing. You gotta be striving. I can't do that anymore. So I'm doing the next best thing, the only other thing I know to do. And that was this waiting or attending. And that's why I love Bob's language so much, because years later, listening attention. And I think that's, if I'd known, if I'd had the words at the time, that would have been a perfect description of the feeling of listening. And that listening attention, that Rose once said, sit in rapport with yourself. And that was a clue. He said, I can remember two clues that he gave me, and that was one of them. Sit in rapport with yourself, and the other one was, your heart is in a locked box. And those are the only two things I feel like he ever said directly to me as, hey, I'm telling you something right now. And you should remember it. So that was my way, that was my discovery of what does it mean to sit in rapport with yourself? Because the feeling that would arrive with him, now I could see it wasn't connected with him. That it was something that was there all the time. And that's when, You know, that's when I get into now, people who talk about, well, it's always here, always right now, always ever present, be here now, all that bullshit is true bullshit. If you find your way to the experience of it, as opposed to going, yeah, oh yeah, I get that, I understand that, which is entirely an intellectual exercise of, that makes sense, that must be the way that it is, and talking yourself into believing that, yes, truth is always here right now, that makes perfect sense to me. Yes, 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 yes. And that's what a lot of people are trying to do. And that's just like going to church. You know, heaven's there waiting for us. And you hear that every week and every week and every week. It reinforces a belief. Well, this is about experiencing, finding a way to experience that, and then you know. So that served me well for quite some time. You know, this idea of sitting in rapport with myself. And that's where I began to actually understand, talk about realizing what life could be about, actually understanding what art really was, what the creative act really was. I began to understand, this, you know, it's an incredible way to live, to let things come into being through you, as opposed to forcing things to happen. But I got to the point where even that, it was a taste, but it wasn't, how to phrase it, it comes and goes. That experience comes and goes. I could sit with a notebook in the woods and have these things come to me and then go away from that. And it didn't. That's all I know how to describe it as. It was a taste. It was like rapport. Rapport is a taste of something. It's an what's the word? An intimation of eternity. It's not the complete experience. And despite if you want to call it the expansion of consciousness or the expansion of what a human being could be, it still didn't answer the fundamental question of who am I? What's going to happen to me when I die? And that's what drove me so much, is death. And that's why I come back to it time and time again. My mortality and the end of Sean just was that, you know, that was my needle in my brain that I just could not get around. Is that someday, as far as I know, there's just a blank wall and I am going to end. And all the things that I cherish and all my memories and all my sense of being, who I am, are here and then nothing. And I did not like that. And I did not like that. So I wasn't satisfied. And I didn't know how to get past that wall. And all I can say is that, you know, and all I can say is that that's the idea of getting back to what is it that you're really trying to answer. And you may find the answer, you may find what settles you anywhere on that continuum. And it may be a house and a little picture. And it may be realizing that there is something greater than you in the world. And it may be the discovery of what you truly are. Your question is your question. And your answer to that is your answer to that. And all that matters is that you keep that in front of you. But for me, the thing was this dead end. And I wanted to know, eventually I wanted to know, as Rose would say, you know, regardless of what the answer is, I want to know what the answer is, because I won't be satisfied until I find out. So to short circuit the story, you know, I went and visited Douglas Harding, and I think some people would like to say, well, Art Tickner, he went to see Douglas Harding, and Bart Marshall, he went to see Douglas Harding, and Sean Nevins, he went to see Douglas Harding. I bet there's something to the Douglas Harding stuff, because they all went to Harding. Gary Harman went to see Douglas Harding. And that was just, you know, going to see Douglas Harding was just a symptom of, I will go somewhere, I will try something new. You know, there was nothing about what Harding did or Harding's experiments other than that they reminded me of what I don't know. And that pushed me, that kept pushing me. And the answer itself came from, as you most of you know, from reading this essay from Franklin Merrill Wolfe called The Induction, and just stumbling upon a set of words that, for some reason, you know, in this crack between dream and dream, for some reason, that set of words forced me to admit to myself, regardless of my objections, of what the truth of me was. And the seeing that the admission of that to myself opened the door, created a moment at which the personality fell away, and Sean fell away, and Sean died, and what was revealed in that absence. That's the best way to intellectually phrase it. So that's why we go around again and again. We say things like, well, there's nothing that you can do, and this is all grace and all of that, and it's true and it's not true, and people get irritated because you won't give a straight answer to anything, and you go, and I go back to just keep in mind what is the thing that you want to know, and that will drive you to the answer. And if there's a practice, that's practice is remembering the question. And all the things that you actually do are just ways of remembering, ways of creating an opportunity that you may admit to yourself the answer that you really already know, but you refuse to look at. You refuse to consider. Because you've got fears or desires or whatever that stand in the way. So that's my story, and I'm going to stick to my story regardless of what questions you may have about it. And there's one thing I wanted to read, because, you know, it summarizes the story, right? And it summarizes the story as the dawn breaks. And the dawn breaks because another day and night have died. but the sky was there through all. The butterfly floats a moment, and then his dalliance is only an eternal picture. And the breast flows with milk and is dry forever. And the lullaby of life and the ear that hear it weaken and cease. Nothing is happening. Nothing is done. The sun rises in glory and the lover stretches his shoulders with ambition. The sunset is forever and the lover drinks of beauty and beauty drinks of the lover. And life loses its pride in death. But nothing is happening. Nothing is done. The eye and the urge are beauty and life. The owner is disenfranchised. The holder lets go of his grasp. And everything becomes his domain. God is in his thought. And his thought lives only in his God. Nothing is judged, nothing is known, nothing is meaningful, everything is perfect.
Say some more about how you understand sitting with yourself in rapport differs from meditation, at least for you.
It differs from meditation, the style of meditation that I was doing, and then it's about receptivity as opposed to meditation. For me, is literally striving and literally energy intensive,
effortful.
Exhausting,
effortful
to the extreme. Yes, to the extreme of where I would get to the point where I just gotta stop because I'm completely exhausted now, and that was from the tension of trying to. You can imagine trying to hold your attention on one point as opposed to here comes a thought, here comes a thought. So it was continually, as Rose would say, turning the mind away. So if I turn away from every distraction that comes up, I stay one pointed and focused. You know, it's like looking at you right now. There are other things calling for my attention. But if I focus, you know, I can remain attentive to you, but eventually I will tire and I want to look away. So that was what meditation was like for me. Sitting in rapport would be like sitting next to you, side by side. Larry is here. I know Larry is over there. But my job is to wait and feel and extend my mental feelers for a hint of your being or the sense of you that is over there. Now you might say, well, aren't distractions coming up and all this kind of stuff? And they are, but maybe there's a curiosity that I didn't have before. I want to feel there's something attractive about. There wasn't a longing for meditation or a feeling component to meditation. There's a longing and a feeling component towards want a connection with you. And then you might could even go so far as to say, and maybe we're talking about love or something like that. I didn't use that language. I didn't think in those terms. But there is a longing and a desire, because there's something pleasant about that connection. But yeah, that's a thought, as opposed to sitting face to face. We're sitting back to back and feeling for one another. Does that help at all?
Yeah. I have a comment about that I hope you'll respond to about...
Negatively?
No, about what you said about the Harding experiments. Because you demonstrated last night something quite different from what you said here.
Damn me!
And that I think is very important about the experiments. Namely, the benefit in them, for me at least, was that they expose beliefs that you didn't know you had.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a lot of this stuff of self-inquiry. You write down something and say, well, that's not true. For me, that's become an empty exercise, because I already know that I'm not sure of anything. But with the Harding experiments, they bring to light something that is not in my consciousness. I can't sit down and write because I'm not aware of the belief. The Harding experiments bring the belief into consciousness, and then you can deal with the false belief. But you can't dismiss it if it isn't in your consciousness. So I think they're pretty useful in that respect. And you seem to kind of be... Maybe I misheard you, but dismissive of that today, whereas you demonstrated it so clearly last night.
Right, and I have done Harding experiments at meetings, and if I were giving a retreat, I would want to do some Harding experiments for the very reasons that you mentioned. And in my experience with Harding, they were reminders, they were pokes. They made me wonder. Yeah, but Harding himself was another human being who had a presence about him that his physicality reminded me that this is real and this is the thing that I want, and that was important for me. Could I say something more about my heart being in a locked box when Rose made that comment? There's actually a story in this book called Tales of Love. And I sat down with him one time, and I wanted to go through the book and just kind of hear what he had to say about the different stories. And we got to that one, Tales of Love, and he said something like, "Oh, you won't understand this one now." And we skipped over it. And I think that was connected with the idea of my heart being in a locked box. That may have been a side comment about that. But that comment goes back to, for me, in my practical experience, that comment of his led to this idea of feeling for another person or sitting in rapport with myself. because I could meditate day in and day out without any feeling or connection to the heart or longing. I could just, it was almost a physical slash mental exercise. It was an exercise that I could do and do and do and do, even if my heart were in a locked box, because the idea is that I'm just going to blast my way through this window and get to the other side. But in terms of intuition and trying to develop the intuition and trying to learn with a different tool, well, I had very little intuition, or I had almost no understanding of this whole part of receiving knowledge from in here. We call it a gut level, a feeling level of making a connection with another person. And I, as a result of his comment, I did several things. I literally, as ridiculous as this sounds, tried to love. And my understanding of love prior to that was acquisition. Of I want that other person. And I will love them, and they will love me. I will get something by giving something. And that's not really love. I tried to... Phil's laughing. And he should be laughing. I literally went out and I hugged a tree. Right? I would go out into the woods and try to feel what a tree felt like. And this seems very mechanical looking back upon it, but that's the level of my development, if you will, in terms of feeling. Of I can't feel anything, really. And I'm going to, what is a tree? What is this? I'm going to try this. There, we had goats on the farm, and I would pick up the baby goats and play with the baby goats, because that was just not part of me to... I actually try to pay attention to the feeling of cherishing some small thing or taking care of some small thing. This goes back to like basic human stuff that I was never exposed to. I got a job working with kids because the idea that children are in some way more connected with the sense of play, right? I had no sense of play. Of just play for the sake of play. Well, I'm going to work with children, so I'll get a chance to play with kids and learn from kids about being more at ease and being more relaxed. Because heart in a locked box is this, right? Going through life like this. I can't expose myself. I can't pay attention to that, or I don't have time for it. I've got more important things, all that business. And playing with children is not like that. It's what do we want to do next, and what's that over there, and this sense of curiosity, all that realm of human experience. I guess you could say I experienced as a result of that comment of his, because I knew that. He says again and again in his books, well, you have two tools. You have intuition and reason. And I had reason out the wazoo, and I had no intuition that I could speak of. And what am I going to do? Well, being a reasonable person, I'll set out a plan of action for how I am going to develop intuition. And it works. I changed. I developed intuition. And you can develop intuition. Can come up with tools to develop intuition. And eventually that led to, sitting in the woods and realizing that there was a language in nature that we could interpret, that nature could speak, that life, that the energy of life could speak through us and is speaking through us all the time. That is what literally brings us into motion. It's not us. We don't do things. We bring things. We're a conduit or a funnel from which things emerge. And that can be covered over by the personality, tainted by the personality, warped, interpreted. And it can also be, you know, the creation of great works of art come about by the same way. Selflessness. You know, when self is removed, amazing things can happen. Things that we could never have imagined can happen.
Talk about being so reasonable and all. Are you trying to tell me that...
I ain't trying to tell you anything, Abernathy.
You weren't always a humorous type person.
You will interpret everything I say and spin it into some way to your advantage. Okay. That's the damn hard thing about this. That's a good question. And no, I think my humor, what humor I have, has expanded over the years.
Okay, now, I'm interested in the phenomenon of laughter, not laughing at somebody. That's a little lightning strike. It involves the intellect, the feeling, and the body. It's completely spontaneous. And also humor. Humor seems to be an important shadow of a shadow of a shadow of something. That's important. It's not serious, but it's a little edging toward a...
Are you one of those laughing yoga guys in disguise?
I'm just thinking about this. Arshan,
what were the few words that Michael Merle had written during the introduction? It's not few.
It's actually a transcription of a talk that he gave, where he was trying to literally induce an experience in people by logically going through a series of steps of what you discover to not be true about yourself. And he talks about something along the lines of, you realize that it's obvious that you're not your body, it's less obvious that you're not your thoughts, and he kind of talks you through this. But he, and it's strange, as he went through that, it's like I was saying, some part of me was saying yes, 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 and knowing that he was, the things that he was saying were true. And at some point in there, he got to a line where he said something along the lines of, it dawns upon you that you are that which is ever an object before consciousness. I think that's the way he phrased it. I don't know what to say except that I remember trying to grasp something that you can't grasp. You know, Rose would talk about the pair of opposites and trying to keep in mind the pair of opposites. And it was as if someone stuck a pair of opposites in my mind. And specifically, it was the idea of black and white. There's black and there's white. And I remember saying to myself several times that there is no black and white. There's not. You know, there's not a pair of opposites. It's in my mind, you know, you can't conceive of that. What does that mean? It means nothing. Yet my mind was somehow wouldn't let go of that. And in order to conceive of that, the mind has to give way. You know, I can tell it's not making any sense what I'm saying. And it's not, and there's not anything about what he said that somehow, oh, it wasn't like a logical progression of, oh yes, now I've come to the conclusion that I believe what he's saying. It was very physical. It was very physical. There was literally something in the room. It was as if an energy descended into the room and forced me to look at the truth about myself. And the truth about myself was that I didn't exist. And with that, with the dawning of that realization, these thoughts about black and white and the opposites and all that just kind of was flooding around. You know, all those details don't really mean much of anything. Because that's just, right, that's a personal view of something impersonal. It's like, I'm trying to describe the moment that I walked out the door. And I changed when I walked through the door. Well, I can only use words up to the point that I opened the door and started to step through. And then it was wordless after that. So all the words are Sean's reaction to something that's actually beyond him or has nothing to do with him. Achieve what he was thinking?
What he was going through his mind in his books and all that. Have you come to any conclusion about that?
If what you're asking is, did Rose achieve an answer to the things that philosophical questions that he had, I would say yes, he did. Did he achieve his desire to communicate that to other people? I would say that he felt like that was a mixed bag of results. I think he always was striving to find a better way to communicate. Yeah. I think he was always a little, this is my projection, he was always a little disappointed in the results.
I think if he had lived at this time and place, he would have been this time.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah.
I can't hear what he said.
Oh, what Mike was saying. Well, Mike was saying that he thought if Rose were around right now that he might feel fairly good about the results of his efforts. I think he would always be disgruntled, actually.
That's what I thought. I just projected.
It's hard to say.
I'm not sure it would take you 2 years.
What are you guys doing with these meetings? Yeah. Shouldn't be doing that. Shouldn't be doing this.
Nobody's moving.
Yeah, right. People just keep coming to these meetings. Nothing's happening.
Yeah.
I found that that's a hard one to pin down, like, for myself at least, just like being really clear about that, because it changes, or I'm not clear what it is, I guess. And so I can see why it's one of the most important things, you know, to provide a direction. But that is a tough one, like, to be really clear about that. And that, you know, for me, I think that there's limit. What can one person really do for another person? You can create opportunities where they can take time away, you know, from the world to figure out what they want. Maybe occasionally you can give somebody some advice that makes some sense to them one-on-one. But for me, one of the most important things is moments. Creating moments where a person knows without a doubt, this is the thing that I want. And that's, you know, that to me is an incredibly valuable service or pointer that you give for someone, is an atmosphere or a mood in which they are allowed to admit to themselves, see clearly that yes, this is the thing that I want. And then it's up to the person when they walk out the door, as we say many a time, to remember that moment of clarity. And I can distinctly remember in my life moments of clarity where I was reminded, this is why I'm living the life that I'm living. This is why I am on a spiritual path.
To say something about that, Rose, being Rose, was always so unpredictable. And I remember first time I stepped on the farm in 1985, very first time I encountered Rose, it was an August Chautauqua, which is an invitation for people that were interested in his system. And the question that he asked was, what do you want out of life? And he went around the room. This is fairly uncharacteristic. He wrote down every answer, and there was peace of mind, permanence, an answer. He got all the various perspectives. And at the end, I remember him saying, after everybody was done, I'm surprised nobody just said happiness. Mm. It's very simple.
Are there any other questions, or are we winding down?